children aren't supposed to die before their parents. Yet moms and dads and other family members wake up every day knowing the little one they once loved isn't physically here anymore. We're talking about grief here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. And our first guest this hour says his grief after losing a child, it creeps up in everyday life. You're part of this conversation. Are you a parent who's experienced the death of a child? How do you deal with this even now? What helps you get through the day? Share your story by calling 800-642-1234. David Frerking is a father of twin sons, both with autism. His son Jacob died of a rare form of cancer in January 2 years ago. David lives in Appleton and published a book journaling about his experience as his son battled cancer. He joins us from our studio in Green Bay. David, thank you for being here on the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Tell us about Jacob. What was he like?
Jacob was a child who knew exactly how to live in the moment. He was the hall monitor in school, if you would. He knew what rules were. He would write down signs and post them so that we knew what to follow with him. He was a strong heart spirit who loved everything about fast cars, NASCAR, and police. And when he had the opportunity to have his wish with Make-A-Wish to become an Appleton police officer, he got to live the dream for the last 16 months that we had him.
What was it like seeing him fulfill that dream of being an officer when you had raised this little rule follower?
That was probably a very proud moment in my life, just seeing the joy in his heart. There's a picture that I have on the book from his wish day that just speaks everything about how he felt about the wish. And, you know, I couldn't be more proud of him on that day.
Take us back to 2016. You get news that Jacob has a rare form of cancer. What do you remember about that moment for you and for your family?
That moment, there's a stage in grief that basically describes shock. There's no way to describe getting that kind of news that in 5 years your child would have a 15% likelihood to still be with you. It's a very surreal moment to where you're in the moment, but it's almost like you're looking at it from a distance. It's really hard to explain.
You've said that Jacob's death was a dark day, but that diagnosis was worse. Why is that?
Any parent out there that finds out their child has something like what he did, you can't help but think, this is the beginning of the end, and how many days do we have left? What day will he go? There's so many things that go through your mind when you hear news like that.
How did you think about your experience then? Because I do think that some people assume that grief starts when someone dies, and what you're saying is it started more than 2 years before you lost Jacob.
It did. He had an episode in, trying to think, March of 2016, where he had multiple grand mal seizures. And when you see fear in an OR surgeon's eyes and nurses off to the side crying, you know things are bad. And that was the night that he got life-flighted. He had probably 24 grand mal seizures between Appleton and Milwaukee. And driving down there with his brother, we really did not know if he would make it to Milwaukee.
David Frerking is a father from Appleton. He lost his son Jacob to a rare form of cancer in January of 2018. We're having this discussion about grief here on the Ideas Network. And you're part of it. Let us know how you have handled your grieving process. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You talked about the course of 22 months with ongoing treatment and hospital visits and overnight stays and more seizures. Tell us about the grief you experienced when you started to realize that this wasn't a fight that Jacob was going to win.
You know, parents in our situation, I can only speak for our situation, we do what we can to know that we tried, and his cancer is 100% terminal. So after 12 rounds of aggressive chemo, he had 14 blood transfusions, several trips by ambulance back and forth between Appleton and Milwaukee. You come to grips without coming to grips with the situation. And part of the reason I started journaling is because my wife, even though we're going through the same journey, if you would, we tended to stay on different stages of grief. And that's another thing that I wanted to point out in the book. It's okay to be in a different spot than your spouse or significant other, because we all have our own unique perspective on the whole situation.
I imagine that's difficult, though, being in one stage, your wife has experienced something else, your son Jonathan had lost a brother. I mean, how do you even try to support one another when you feel like you're in different places with coping with this?
I came to grips early on that my wife is also diagnosed bipolar, so I married her for good or for bad and knew that I had to be the foundation to hold the family together as good as I could try. And the same thing for our son, John, because he is not completely verbal, so has so many emotions going on that he can't necessarily let out and explain what he's feeling. I struggled still to this day in just trying to be what they need to get through this ordeal.
When Jacob passed away, and even in the lead up as he battled cancer, what kind of support did you find from friends and family?
Jacob, I think his funeral here in Appleton, we had two, one here and one in his hometown of Houston. His Appleton funeral, we probably had to anywhere from 300 to 400 first responders. He had a full police burial ceremony, and I probably hugged 400 people between the fire departments, local law enforcement, judges, teachers, everybody that came into contact or knew of Jacob's story. So we had a lot of support. We still have a lot of support to this day through APD and our contacts with Make-A-Wish.
I also understand you're part of a grief group. Why did it help you to be around other people who were experiencing different things but still loss?
For me, it helped me come to grips that even though I have no idea what my unfortunate peers have gone through, it kind of helps hearing their perspectives of what they went through. We both went through the same act of losing a child. Our stories are just dramatically different. And you have a level of respect in speaking to people who have gone through much of what you've gone through, and you work together to help cope through the situation. It's something I strongly recommend for anybody who's had any type of loss.
Do you want us to keep asking about Jacob into the future?
Ask away.
So it's not, I think some people are scared because they don't want to bring up more pain. Does it hurt more when people talk about him, or does it help you?
Grief is a roller coaster of emotions, and there's several phases of it. Several studies have anywhere from 5 to 6 phases of grief, and they can randomly hit you at any point in time. It helps to come to grips with knowing what your triggers are, but some days I could tell a story that happened with a high level of pride, and other days I could just barely get the words out.
Yeah, and David, thank you so much for joining us this morning and sharing Jacob's story.
Thank you very much.
David Frerking is the father of Jacob Frerking, who died in 2018 from a rare form of cancer. David lives in Appleton and published a book, What Really Matters, which is a collection of journal entries during his experience as his son battled the disease. He joined us from Green Bay this morning, and we're talking about grief here on The Morning Show. Stay with us. The conversation continues on the Ideas Network. Shock, anger, denial, just a few of many emotions we experience in grief. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Grief is a natural response to loss. In this hour, we're discussing how to process it. There's no timetable, but we do have healthy ways to cope when someone we love is gone. Acknowledge the pain, seek support, take care of yourself physically and emotionally. Gradually, healing happens. Share your story with us. Are you grieving the loss of a loved one? Do you know someone who's grieving the loss of someone they lost shortly ago or maybe decades ago? How are you providing them with support? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also share your story by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Jonathan Singer is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago. He's also president of the American Association of Suicidology and hosts the Social Work podcast. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be back.
We just had a conversation with a father who'd lost his son, and what he left us with was this idea that some days are okay, some days he can tell stories, and then there are other moments that it just creeps up on him and is overwhelming. Is that how grief works?
Yeah, that's absolutely one of the ways that grief works. You know, grief is this intense psychological response that accompanies the experience of loss, and bereavement is the word we use to call the experiencing of loss, and people have different ways that they grieve. For many folks, grief looks like a really intense reaction in the beginning, and then over time, they move back into sort of a new normal. But one where they're able to go to work and interact with friends. And there are those moments, weeks, months, and years later, where the grief just hits them so intensely.
But that's so frustrating, right? Like we even talk about it as like the stages of grief. Like we should be able to go in a linear fashion through these steps and just get through it and be done. That's not how grief actually works, though.
No, and you know, when you talk about the stages of grief, I think most people think about the Kubler-Ross, right? The five stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work was really important when it came out. Most people don't know that she developed those stages talking with people who were dying. So she actually developed those stages, or she discovered those stages, about the experience that people had for themselves when they were going through the process of dying. What we've done in society is we have said this is a stage model for people who are grieving the loss of somebody who's died. And there's a psychologist named Bonanno who's done research to say that actually Kubler-Ross's stages of grief and loss don't really fit, right? Just what you said about it's not this stage thing where we can go through denial and then anger, then bargaining, then acceptance, or then depression and then acceptance, and we're done. But that most people experience some pretty intense grief reactions. And then, like I said, the new normal. I like to think about it as, you know, when somebody first dies, it's like hitting a wall, right? You run into that wall and it's painful and it's surprising and it's shocking. And sometimes you don't know where to go, how to get around the wall. You don't know how tall the wall is. You don't know how wide it is. But eventually, usually with the help of friends and community, you scale the wall and you get on the other side and you keep going. And then
I think we may have lost you, Jonathan. Thanks so much. We'll try to reconnect as we're talking about how the stages of grief don't necessarily work the way we assume that they do. You can't move from just one to the next like stairs and think that eventually you'll get to the top and everything will be better. We're spending this hour on the morning show on grief, and there's a line for you to share your experience to help us understand what you're dealing with. Maybe you are a counselor and you work with people who are in the process of mourning. What do you tell them? Perhaps you've experienced a loss recently or long ago. How does that change the way you look at the world? Does grief creep up on you, or have you found a way to cope that helps you be encouraged? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. There's a line for you there, along with Jonathan Singer, who's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago. And Jonathan, I want to go ahead and let you pick up where we left off in talking about the nonlinear aspects of grief.
Yeah, and I'm so sorry I got I lost you there. So grief and loss is really nonlinear. You have these stages of grief and loss, and then there's a psychologist, Bonanno, who suggests that that we all go through grief and loss, but it's not sequential, mm-hmm. right? Most of us do go through these stages where we're feeling intense grief, and then over time, it becomes a new normal.
And
go ahead.
Well, I want to acknowledge that this is a really personal conversation. I think most people have experienced some form of grief, and we talked with a Wisconsin man earlier this morning. And I also appreciate the fact that you've shared with us that you are experiencing grief now following the death of a family member this week. And I want to know, when you are armed with all of these tools to where you are able to help other people try to cope with this, how do you begin even processing this loss?
Yeah, so my wife's grandfather died yesterday. He was almost 99, and his death is what we in the business call an on-time death. He was an older adult. He had been ill. There have been several times over the past several years where he had experienced a physical complication like a stroke or inability to swallow, which made us think, okay, he might be dying. And on-time deaths, even those like my wife's grandfather, are surprising, right? They're different than what David was mentioning about his son, which he was anticipating, but there's something about losing a child that is even different than losing a grandparent, which we consider sort of part of the cycle of life, right? The grandparents, they die. And it's to have a parent lose a child is something I think everybody agrees nobody should ever have to go through.
And certainly the way that we work through grief can be informed or changed by the relationships we have with people who've died. But even regardless of the relationship, some deaths just hit us harder than others. Why is that?
Oh,
I know, big question.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
It is a lot. And I think that one of the things that – first of all, I think – you know, the loss of a child, for example, is a death that I imagine hits most people pretty hard. The death of a parent, I think, is also something that's painful. But again, like I said, it is something that we have stories about. We anticipate throughout our entire lives, right? And so this speaks to the fact that death is one of these socially constructed experiences. And I think the internet has really changed the way that we think about death, because for, you know, the last 100 years, death in the United States has been fairly private. You know, lots of people died in hospitals, even though hospitals didn't want to acknowledge that people died there. And dying at home, even though that's something that had happened throughout history, happened much less often. But today you can go on Facebook or Instagram or any of the social media, and you can see death notifications on a regular basis. And so death has become public again, and it speaks to that idea that it's socially constructed.
And one note on that I think we should mention is that, because news travels faster, sometimes people unfortunately get news that way. So it's probably good not only to be able to share in that experience, but also to think before you click if something is new and raw. Is that fair advice from the armchair person over here?
Oh, I think the armchair person has it exactly right. I think, think before you click. Also, you know, if we think about death being public in the digital age, in a way that it wasn't even 20 years ago, I think it's a reasonable thing to consider providing kids and adults with death education, right? We think about sex education, death education, and, you know, some listeners might be thinking, I don't want to talk about death. And really what I'm saying is that it's appropriate to say, what should you do if you see somebody post about death?
Yeah. And let's talk more about that moving forward. Jonathan Singer stays with us this hour, teaches social work at the college level, and we're talking about grief. There are room for your stories here. Tell us about a loved one that you miss. What's your favorite memory? 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to The Ideas Network. Grief is confusing and scary. Our minds seem to go numb, and yet we can't seem to slow them down. And we often feel physical pain as we grapple with a loss that hurts more than we think we can take. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about grief here on The Morning Show. And not just the stages of grief, but also how we expect people to behave when someone dies, and the sometimes arbitrary standards we set for ourselves when we're working through a loss. There's room for you in this discussion at 800-642-1234. Are you grieving or know someone who is? Perhaps you're thinking of a specific loved one during this conversation. What's your favorite memory about them? What do you want to keep with you even as you cope with the loss? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Jonathan Singer is with us on the Ideas Network. He's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago. And Jonathan, I want to mention that I remember when I was a kid and my great aunt Elsie died, and she lived at the nursing home in our small town. I would go play bingo some Saturdays, get dollar store prizes when I won. And when I got the news that she had died, I was really worked up. And somebody in my family looked at me and said, "Why are you crying? You didn't even know her that well." Yeah. And they were right, right? Like, I didn't. And I was a kid, and I hadn't seen all of these amazing things she's done in her life or know her well, but I still felt it. I mean, how close do we need to be to someone to feel grief and experience that?
I mean, we don't have to know somebody personally at all. So there are two things that I want to say. First of all, I think that that person was incredibly sad about the loss of your aunt. And they were thinking, you didn't know her like I knew her. How could you be feeling sad in the same way that I'm feeling sad? And I think one of the things that's really important to remember in a situation where there's the loss of a loved one is that all loss is honored, and that people's responses are reasonable. When you have somebody who is a celebrity, right, like Kobe Bryant or David Bowie or Prince, or Princess Diana, you had people really grieving the loss of this person that they didn't know except in the media, right? And it's because we make meaning out of their lives. You made meaning out of your aunt's life. The meanings were wrapped up in the little prizes that you got, the fact that you were special because you were able to play bingo with her, that probably people were like, "Oh, she's so cute," you know, as you go around, right? So as a kid, that's legitimate. And that is a legitimate experience. And so your sense of sadness and loss was real, and it was legitimate, as legitimate as somebody else's, even if you didn't have the same experience as they did.
Well, and you mentioned Kobe Bryant, and that's another name that has really been in the headlines since his death, and people feeling that intensely, which kind of brings us back to the internet aspect of this and the death education concept that you mentioned.
Yes. You know, and I'll say that there's one of the things about the internet is that you have instant access to everything about a person's life. And so talking about death becomes very complicated because you have people that have differences of opinions and they share them online. And so if you have a celebrity that dies, you might have some people who are saying, you didn't know him, get over it. And you might have other people who are saying, he's not deserving of our sadness. And others who are saying, I'm only going to wear the number 24 for as long as I can. and suddenly the community, which might have been 10 people or 100 people or, you know, 200 people, suddenly becomes millions of people. And we have to negotiate all of those differences of opinions and experiences, which is one of the reasons why I think this idea of death education's a pretty good idea for folks.
And Jackie from Greenfield wants to join the conversation with us now. Jackie, thanks for being here.
Good morning. My mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, and she died 30 days later. I'm grateful for FMLA because I was able to spend the last 3 weeks with her. And I was very surprised that she made it a positive experience. She told me and my nephews, her grandkids, you know, everybody dies, and she planned her funeral, and she, you know, we celebrated life and went through pictures, and like I said, I was surprised at how positive she made it.
Wow, Jackie, thank you for being willing to share that about your mother. And it sounds like Jackie's mom really handled this in a way that that helped her, but also helped the people around her. Jonathan, what a gift to the people who are still here.
Yeah, I mean, that's Jackie. It's very sorry about your mom's death, and it sounds like it was really a gift that she gave you, and it probably speaks to who she was when she was alive, that she was able to embrace her death, possibly in the way that she embraced life. And I think this is one of the things about dying that we don't often think about, which is that you know, it is part of the life cycle, and your the way that people negotiate how they have lived their lives, do they feel like they have lost or they have lived a good life where they have done what they had wanted to do, where they feel like they have left a legacy. All of these things play into how the person who is dying negotiates those final stages.
I just wanted to say, Jackie, I so appreciate the fact that you told your story and also, you know, highlighted the fact that, again, we've been talking about how this is different for everyone. We talked about a long battle ahead of a death, and we talked about an expected death of someone who's older, still being hard. But Jackie's mom had this kind of in the middle stage where she knew she had just a limited amount of time, but it wasn't sudden. And so it's just a reminder that there really is different in each of these individual circumstances.
Absolutely. So much difference in the types of deaths and the length of time and our expectation for what that looks like. You know, there's this idea of we call sudden or violent death. And my area is suicide. And suicide death is considered a sudden and violent death for the most part. And it's very quick. And the experience is very different than somebody who, you know, like Jackie's mom, dies quickly, but in a planful way.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to mention, if you or someone you know is experiencing thoughts of suicide, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. Let me give you that number. It's 800-273-8255. It's 800-273-8255. Please give that number a call. We're talking with Jonathan Singer, who is an associate professor of sociology at Loyola University in Chicago, and we're talking about all forms of grief. He's also president of the American Association of Suicidology. And there is room for you in this discussion if you'd like to share an experience that you've had, something that's helped you in your grief, or maybe a fond memory of someone that you miss. The number to call to speak with us is 800-642-1234. And we've got Neil from Monona on the line. Hi, Neil.
Good morning. Good morning.
What story did you want to share today?
Well, in 2007, my daughter of 19 years old, and she was a young mother of a 20-month-old baby girl, she suddenly passed away and with a medical condition, which was devastating. Shortly after that, like 2 weeks after that, my wife's grandmother passed away out in California. And so that just compiled everything. In 2013, my stepdaughter's biological father unexpectedly died in an airplane crash in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And so we've been through, you know, different stages.
Yeah.
And for myself, I think, and I can speak for my wife too, it's in a way it's hardened us, you know, to death, where it's kind of a, as a matter of fact, you know, type thing that happens.
Yeah.
But where we really struggled with it was, you know, besides the grieving, you know, and how everybody grieves differently, but it was the effects of dealing with, you know, our families and our you know, people closely, you know, to us, how they dealt with it, you know, like for my granddaughter, because we've raised her, you know, since then, but how everybody wants to continue to live through, you know, the person that died, through the surviving, you know, children, and it really brings a lot of different types of, you know, emotions and just struggles, you know, that come with it, you know, for the people that are left behind.
Neil, thank you for being so honest about all of the loss that you've experienced, and we really appreciate your willingness to share with us. We're actually talking all hour about grief. Jonathan Singer is our guest. He's talking with us this hour about the process of grieving, answering your questions, sharing in your stories. Jonathan works as an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago. And there's still time for you to share your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about how you handle grief and what's helped you, and maybe what you wanted people to say. Did you want them to stop talking to you, or did you want them to ask more questions and keep the memories alive? Let us know at ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you for being here with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is The Morning Show. We're spending this hour on grief and trying to understand how we can work through loss. Our guest is Jonathan Singer, who studies suicide intervention, cyberbullying, family-based intervention. He's also the founder and host of the Social Work Podcast. And we're taking your calls now, your questions and thoughts. And let's go ahead and welcome Haley from Milwaukee to the conversation. Haley, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What are you wondering this morning?
Well, I have a really close friend who recently moved across the country. He was raised by his grandparents because his parents passed away when he was young. But he remembers that, was there for it. And so he lost his grandpa a few years ago, and he wasn't able to be there right before he died. So he's had his grandma, and that's it. And she was just put into hospice. And I want to know the you know, they always just say, just be there for them. But how do you be there for someone who's all the way across the country who you can't even give a hug to? And someone who has no family left. And, you know, what do you say that's more than I'm sorry?
Yeah, Haley, thank you so much for that question. Jonathan, where do we start?
Well, you know, Haley, this is such a tough situation for you and your friend. I think the first thing that we need to do as supporters is to acknowledge what's going on for us, right? So I heard it in your voice towards the end, how painful this is for you, probably because of how much you care for your friend. And so the first thing is to get in touch with your own thoughts about and feelings about his situation and the losses that he's going through. Because what we want to do is when we're there for somebody, even remotely, is to be able to listen to them, to be able to validate their experiences and recognize when our own experiences might be taking center stage. We want to be able to check in with them if that's what they want, right? Remotely or even in person. And that could mean like sending text messages like, just want to let you know that I'm thinking about you today. Or if there's something specific to say, you know, did your grandmother see the doctor? Would love to hear, right? Whatever it is that would be support for your friend is great. The fact that you're remote and it's online or it's over text, I don't actually think that that's so much of an issue because of how intense our connections can be with folks online. And so I would just say it sounds like you care deeply about this person, to acknowledge that he is probably experiencing multiple levels of grief. Because every time we experience a new loss, old loss comes up. And just to, I know it sounds hackneyed, but to be there for him, to listen and to provide for him what he needs in this moment.
Haley, thank you so much for the question. It's a really important one, and best of luck with everything. Let's bring in Jan from River Hills now. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I am concerned for my grandchildren. I am extremely close to them, and my question is how do I broach the subject of, A, you know, trying to prepare them that something will eventually happen to me, and B, would it be better for them if I were not so close to them that they would not have to deal with the issue of, you know, being so close to someone and having them pass away?
Oh, Jan, thank you so much for the question. And as someone who's very close to her grandparents, I'm just going to say no. Definitely, it is not better if you weren't so close to them. Believe me, I cherish those moments. But Jonathan, certainly, you're the expert here. What do you have to say to Jan?
Well, one thing I don't know how old Jan's grandkids are, but what I will say is that there's a myth that younger children, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, should be protected from death. And in fact, kids oftentimes respond to death much better than adults. They don't have the same stories and expectations and beliefs and understandings about what it should mean or what it could mean. I know that when my grandfather died, my daughter was young, and she said, "Oh, I'm sad that, you know, Papa," that's what we called him, "has died." And, you know, she processed it over the next couple of days, and then it just became part of her life. And so I just want to encourage folks to again, check in about what are the things that you think death means, and then to be very clear that, especially with younger folks, it doesn't necessarily mean those things. It's like a seed that you plant in the ground that grows into a flower, and at the end of the season, the flower is gone. Kids oftentimes understand that that is the cycle of life, and they don't ascribe meaning to it in the way that adults might.
Mm. Thank you so much, Jan, for your questions. Good luck with those conversations with them. Jonathan Singer is an associate professor of sociology at Loyola University Chicago, and we're talking about grief. And Margie from Milwaukee is on the line. Good morning, Margie.
Hi. Thank you for this program. This past weekend in Milwaukee, a little five-year-old boy was gunned down in the crosshairs of some fight. And he was a little buddy of my five-year-old granddaughter in kindergarten. And so I'm curious how to help her because we're really close. And also, how in the world does a kindergarten teacher deal with this?
Yeah, good questions, Margie. Jonathan, we're just talking about kids trying to process death, you know, when we're talking about older family members. But what happens when a classmate dies, especially so suddenly?
Well, first of all, this is, sounds like a tragic loss for the whole community, and I'm so sorry. A couple things. One, I'm going to address the kindergarten teacher. First of all, the kindergarten teacher should have tons of support from the school. There should be folks who are available to provide the kindergarten teacher with counseling and help processing. Oftentimes teachers and other professionals sort of jump in and say, I'm good. I don't need your, I thank you for your help, but I'm a professional. I have to care for others. And that can be really hard over the long term. So I hope the kindergarten teacher has support. Number two, the other kids in the class, your granddaughter, will, for some of them, it might be the first time somebody's died. And at age 5 or 6, there is a way in which you can understand it in a very concrete way that can actually be helpful in integrating it fairly quickly. At the same time, kids might not understand. They might, they're engaged in magical thinking. So they might think, oh, well, he's going to come back in a couple of days. He's going to climb down a ladder and he's going to come back into our classroom. And so you have to be, you know, that's kind of magical thinking, like what happens when people die. You have to be prepared for that. And hopefully the kindergarten teacher in the school will be ready for those developmental tasks. A very concrete thing is for kids is drawing pictures, reading stories about people who have died and how people move on and what it means for the adults around them.
Lots of options there for sure. And Margie, we were thinking of your granddaughter and her classmates then in that circumstance, especially as you have those difficult conversations. And Jonathan, it's clear from our callers that this is kind of a universal experience, even as it's different. So we really just appreciate the amount of time and the care that you've taken when talking about grief. It's certainly something that that doesn't completely go away. So thank you for your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Jonathan Singer is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago. He's also president of the American Association of Suicidology. And we spent the hour talking about grief, sharing our stories, finding out how to better support each other as we deal with living through loss. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.